Welcome to the 16th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Timmy Chad.
And I regret to inform you that after 2 weeks of trying, we still haven't managed to hack into Sachin Tendulkar's voicemail.
And I'd imagine that if we did, we would find absolutely nothing controversial whatsoever.
He's sort of just perfect, isn't he? He's too sensible. There wouldn't be, well, at the best, maybe a message from Roger Federer?
Yep, his good friend Roger Federer. But certainly I don't think we'd find he'd slept with any supermodels or anything.
No, and given that we're hoping, for reasons to be revealed later, to have a few more Indian listeners on the show, we definitely don't want to cast any aspersion on Sachin Tendulkar,
whom
we think is brilliant.
Celebrity aside, we've just finished a very interesting one-day series between England and Sri Lanka. Do you think England have salvaged their one-day record from it?
Well, I wondered to what extent England needed to salvage something here. I think people have been excessively critical of this England side, this England one-day side. I think they had a horrible winter in Australia in the one-day format. They obviously had a wonderful time in the test format. I think they had a difficult World Cup. But I actually think over the last couple of years, they have been making progress here. And this was a really good win. It was a good win against a decent side. What do you think Alistair Cook's done for himself in this series?
Well, I was actually going to say two things in response to what you just said. One of which is it's all very well to look at history and sort of cherry-pick the best bits and say England have been on an upward trajectory, apart from the dreadful World Cup and a dreadful series against the West Indies and also another dreadful couple of one-day series on the way. But anyway, that aside, you said that people have been overly negative. I remember this time 2 weeks ago sitting here and defending Alistair Cook to the hilt and saying, come on, at least let's give him a try, when you were saying he's in there for all the wrong reasons.
I will put my hand up, and if Alistair Cook is listening, which I'm sure he should be,
well,
I
exactly,
apologise.
Exactly, I'm sure he was looking for an apology as well from us, because it matters. I was very impressed by the way that after all the criticism, he came out in that fourth one-day international, and him and Kiesewetter batted very impressively together. Not only did Cook score quickly and score a lot of runs, but the partnership worked very well, actually. And the way that Kiesewetter automatically took a back seat when Cook was firing off and hitting fours and sixes all over the place. So I'm really impressed by the
and
way
Alistair Cook's coming. It does look like a more stable side now. I mean, Cook and Kiesewetter are now the England one-day openers. You wouldn't see them changing that. So away from England's success in the one-days, the County 2020 has finally, after each county has played a faintly ludicrous 16 games each, has finally come to an end.
But we do have one thing. I mean, the one thing that we will remember from this year's 2020 is Aral Spire's absolutely remarkable bowling figures, taking 6 for 5 against Glamorgan. This for a spinner playing in a 2020 at Taunton. And you think the odds are stacked against him. He's also gone on to make 150 against India in that tour match. So that for me has been a real highlight of the 2020 his performance. Yeah. And I think spinners overall have done quite well.
I mean, I've been very excited by another spinner, Essex's Tim Phillips. Very interesting player in that his major injury problems meant his career never really got going until about 26. And as a first-class player, very miserable average of almost 47. But he's a player transformed in 2020. I mean, he's the tournament's lead wicket-taker with 26. An astonishing strike rate of 11. And very interesting, a bowler who very much relies on flight rather than turn. Perhaps suggesting that that's how you do the business, maybe, in this form of the game. But with the end of the 2020, we now find ourselves being dragged back to the serious business of County Championship, and of course the even more serious business of the Telegraph County Cricket Fantasy Challenge. I think I've added several words to that, but anyway,
it's official title
anyway,
is TBC.
We'll cut to the stats here, which is that
can we not?
We'll cut briefly to stats. I find myself sitting in a proud 9,008. You found yourself, gracefully chilling out in the 14,000 and a little bit.
But what I'm doing is I'm hanging back in the second pack, ready to pounce in the final. And in fact, I think over the last week I've actually done better than you have.
You beat me over the last week.
You're not as sure as you have been. I've made the mistake of keeping a close eye on the 4-day county games, but without actually really translating any of that to my to my fantasy.
Not been enough transfer.
Team. There hasn't been enough transfer. Dealing. I've been James Foster has done rather bad in his ban from 2020s. We'll go on and talk later about that and the implications of that. And I hope that's not going to affect him in the 4-day game. Chiminda Voss, who I'm very perturbed to learn that you have stolen.
It's a cutthroat world.
He can't play for two teams.
I'm afraid
I've
picked him up.
Has been doing very well, but my real story is Ed Joyce, who's always been a bit of a nearly man, and I sort of thought I'd give him a chance. I felt a bit sorry for him, so I put him in my side, and I've been really enjoying his performance actually for Sussex second 11.
He scored
46 and 13 against the MCC youth team, and then since returning to the first team, he's made a three ball duck and a laborious 16. So I think I'm going to have to put him into the race here. But you've been making some changes.
Well, I've been making some changes. Adil Rashid, I love him as a young English leg spinner. I'm desperate for him to do well, but unfortunately he's failed rather dismally as my captain.
Against someone who you hope will do well.
He was a pick very much from the heart when I gave him the chance to lead, you know, my team. But anyway, he's gone, he's been dropped, and I've brought in a much more reliable, the outstanding player, certainly one of the outstanding players of the season, Marcus Trezegothic, who I have to believe, unless my team really is a curse, you know, I hope he'll pile up the points. My other dealing has seen Matthew Hoggard, who's managed to break his hand on a punch bag. Less said about that, perhaps the better. And I have, in a very cutthroat way, chosen one of your best players, Chiminda Voss, and he'll be replacing him. My star has been James Harris at Glamorgan. I mean, what a player for someone of his age. Doing superbly well, and I've rewarded him by making him my new captain. So I'm
when you say you've rewarded him, I'm not sure he's going to take it all that.
Well, I don't know.
Do you remember with Tamagotchis? There was that for a phase at which
I'm people used to get.
Used to get really, really sad because these little computerized animals used to die, and people used to get very attached to them. And it seems as if you're sort of thinking that James Harris is actually going to take this very personally in this game. The fact that you've checked the captain box.
I imagine Adil Rashid would be genuinely upset that he's dropped, and I imagine James Harris will be genuinely delighted. It shows a key turning point in both of
their
careers.
Your man management astounds me.
Probably the most distressing incident I've had is one of my stars, James Taylor, being bowled out by one of my other stars, Ravi Bapara. Mm. And it's extremely annoying.
You don't really know what to think there, do you?
Extremely annoying when your players gang up on each other. Well, the time's come to turn our attention to the main event of this summer, India's visit to England. They're already here, having not a huge amount of fun in Somerset as we speak. But we have, very, very excitingly this week, a reverse radio first. We have a subcontinental collaboration. Gaurav from the Naked Cricket blog, a member of the excellent Board Cricket Crazy Indians group blog, which we'll be chatting about more later in the show, has honoured us with a rather fantastic two-minute preview.
Hi, I'm Gaurav Sethi. I'm also Naked Cricket and a board member of Board Cricket Crazy Indians, BCCI. I've been asked to preview the India-England Test Series, but previews are not what I do. I prefer to make early board calls. So be warned, this is a spoiler. And if you hear this, you may not want to watch the four test series. England will win the NPAR test series 1-0. As an English cricket fan, isn't that what you want to believe? And this is an English radio station with largely English listeners. Just imagine what something like this will do for the reach of reverse swept radio. They could go on to sweep the Lowlands, Midlands and Scotland. Okay, not quite Scotland, but pretty much all of England. England can and should win 1-0 at least. India lack a set opening partnership. Gambhir returns from injury, and Mukund will not go beyond 50 in any of the innings he plays, for he may not even play one innings. India will at Lord's resort to playing both Raina and Yuvraj. Greedy, no doubt, to play two poster boys and kill them with one stone and one innings, and the extra spinners and the left armour to thwart KP. This will be a mistake, a big one at that. Dravid will be made to open, Lakshman at 3, Sachin at 4, as always. England will continue their fantastic record at Lord's. They will win Lord's. Of course, this isn't how it will turn out. An early board call. Now, for our Indian listeners, India will win 3-0, and Sachin Tendulkar will get his name on the honours board at Lord's, and every cricket nymph will have his name tattooed on his and her breast. That'll be all. And as we often say in India, thank you, Sachin. Thank you. Thank you.
It's great to have a voice from the other side of the world, particularly in a series which seems to be so important for both sets of supporters.
And I mean, for England fans, it's traditionally always about the Ashes, but I actually think this is a rare example where this is a series that is certainly on a parallel with the Ashes. I mean, a lot of people, I think, are seeing it as a sort of number one versus number two battle, really, for
Test. A bit harsh on South Africa.
I think it is a bit harsh on South Africa. I think both these sides have struggled against South Africa recently, so they would have a very strong claim.
But what it certainly does, it, whether or not it's a tussle between one and two, it's a series that could define the Strauss-Flower era for England, and similarly for India, you've got a slightly funny time where this is presumably Tendulkar's last tour of England.
And obviously
Duncan Fletcher here. And you just get the sense that for both sides, this could really sort of define an era for them.
Mm. And how they're viewed. I mean, there is that issue, obviously, for India winning in England would be a big thing, but for either of these sides, it's going to be a huge, huge result. I mean, this, it's obviously very difficult with so many different world-class players on the show. Do you see one player in particular coming to the fore here?
Well, I was really disappointed by the fact that Sehwag isn't going to be coming in and opening the batting.
Any cricket fan is disappointed
and dismantling
played.
England from day one of the first test. But I think that when he comes back after the, I think he's, at the moment they think he's going to come back in the third test, is that right? And I think when he comes back, he could make a huge impact. I think the other person who, for India, could have a very big impact is Zaya Khan, who is absolutely the essential linchpin for this Indian attack. I mean, I was thinking about Runoff Patel, who's had absolutely no luck at all in the match against Somerset going on at the moment. And actually, I thought when watching him in the World Cup as well, which is the only time I've seen him really extensively, I didn't think he had much of a cutting edge.
No, and I mean, Zaya Khan consistently looks like the Indian bowler who is going to take wickets. I mean, he has had a lot of success against Andrew Strauss, particularly in the past. I mean, I'm excited from maybe an English view about Chris Tremler. I think he's really come of age. You know, it's sometimes overstated, this idea that Indian batsmen can't deal with the short ball. Nevertheless, I think they will find Tremler the most difficult to deal with in England's bowlers. He's got such confidence, such aggression at the moment.
And I think the way that the bowlers will fare altogether is going to be really interesting for the series, the way that the captains uses the bowlers, because I think it's going to be a very batsman heavy series. We're going to see a lot of runs scored, and I can't see too many, you know, batting collapses. Both sides have got very strong batting lineups.
How do you think the Indian spin attack is going to come together? I mean, do you think they'll work effectively as a unit?
I almost have no idea, because Mishra's leg spin is going to be very interesting. I don't think I've actually ever seen him bowl at any great length. I don't know if you have. Suresh Raina, who I was very impressed with his occasional offies in the World Cup, when he bowled well, he bowled very well, I thought. But I just think that for both sides, the balance of the attack and the way that I think the captains are going to have to be really innovative, because wickets are going to be hard to come by.
I mean, I think for me personally, the sight of the summer might well be seeing Sachin Tendulkar. He's the kind of player where you expect him to finish in style, and this will be his last series in England, so I'd expect him to do something special. Ian Bell as well. I mean, you know, for so long, this unfulfilled talent, he's playing so brilliantly, and he's also combining that with the sort of consistency and mental strength that he lacked. I think he is perfectly set up as a player to do some real damage, actually, against the Indians.
Exactly, but playing in the middle order, and actually, India don't have much express pace in there.
No.
Middle order, and that's really when Bell thrives against bowlers who have got who are a yard or two shorter in pace than the very quickest.
And certainly his footwork against those bowlers and to the spinners. I mean, we've argued before about the balance of the England side. I mean, do you think they've got the right starting 11 going into the series?
This four bowler issue that we talked about before the Sri Lanka series, and back then even we were saying that against a really strong Indian batting lineup, if you're going to take four bowlers, then those four bowlers all need to fire. Now we have a very, very big issue with Stuart Broad and the number of wickets he is or is not taking. And it's not so much that he's not taking wickets, it's the fact that he's really not bowling very well at the moment. Mm. I mean, in any form of the game, really.
And it appears to be more than just a dip. I mean, I think the concern with Broad is that mentally he just seems to be struggling with the pressures of the game at the moment. No question, I think, about his ability and about his long-term prospect with the England team, but I'm increasingly wondering whether Tim Bresnan isn't the safer choice. I mean, I think on the full, I think England will certainly stick with the four bowlers, but whether they'll be able to get the 20 wickets, I think, is sort of harder to see, maybe.
So, a prediction. Stick our necks up.
I think it's going to be a draw. I think it's going to be 1-1. I think it's going to be a very tight series, and there's very little in between the sides. And I think it's going to be attrition. I think big, big scores will be put up, and big sides will have to respond to that. Nature of the pitches is going to be huge, I think, in this series. I think you've made the point already that you can see a huge number of runs. I mean, if there are good batting tracks with little in it for the bowlers, I think, I hate to say it, but I think there is a risk this could become just a run fest and not much of a contest.
I think you're slightly ambitious saying, because I don't think that two out of the four matches are going to end in results, precisely for that reason that I think the batsmen are the stronger suits for both sides. I think that there'll be one victory where I'm not sure, but certainly not at, probably not at the Lords or the Oval. I think we can pretty safely say that those are going to be fairly flat tracks, which are going to produce a lot of runs. But I would both, I think, in my head and my heart, in saying that England might pip it 1-0. From the archives, and this week we are going back all the way to March 1956 and a match between New Zealand and the West Indies, a match which would have been lost in the mists of time, I'm sure. I mean, when you look down the New Zealand side, and I can't say there are any names I immediately recognised.
No, it's not.
There's a chapel, but it's spelt wrongly to the famous chapels.
There aren't many names that grab you, are there?
There aren't.
But this was very much the time where New Zealand were minnows, weren't they?
And it was, and it is a notable match because it is New Zealand's first victory in Test matches. They'd been a Test playing nation for some 25, I'm not very good at maths, 25 years from, well, they were a Test playing nation since 1929, but for many years they were very much seen as a sort of a second string side. England refused to play full 5-day Test matches against them and insisted on playing 3-day matches. But it's actually at one point, in a game that we've looked at on Reverse Vert Radio, worked out in England's favour about a decade before the game we're looking at today. New Zealand could well have beaten England, but the fact that it was a 3-day match meant they didn't have enough time. Mm. So there is that. There is also the fact that Australia for many years didn't play a test against New Zealand because there was always this antagonism between the two cricketing boards, and the New Zealand cricketing board would never pay the proper touring fee to the Australian side.
Which seems extraordinary that they would seem such natural rivals and competitors.
Exactly.
They should have been playing regularly.
And so despite having been a full Test playing nation since 1929, they never really came onto the international scene sort of properly for quite a long time. And even in the 50s, there were still quite a lot of firsts. They played their first test against the Windies in the 51-52 series. A fascinating series. It's the Windies win 1-0. The first test, the Windies win by 5 wickets, but it's actually quite close. And then the second test, the West Indies go out and rack up some 600 in their first innings. But then also in 55-56, New Zealand played their first ever test against India and Pakistan. Just 1 year before, they'd scored the lowest ever innings total, and it still stands in cricket. They made just 26 against England. And so by the time that they go to the West Indies for this series, things aren't looking great, particularly after they lose the first 3 games in the series, 2 of them by innings and another by 9 wickets. So the stage most certainly is not set for their first ever Test victory.
I mean, it's been within the, you know, they are very much the Bangladesh of their time, and they're being hammered. They're actually, sorry, it's in New Zealand actually, but they're being hammered by a West Indies side that were a long way from their peak, but were clearly, you know, led by, or they had the excellent Everton Weekes, and were clearly, you know, very much stronger. New Zealand won the toss, chose to bat, but soon in trouble at 87 for 4. The spin of Alf Valentine causing particular problems. Interesting, Captain John Reid. We're not, as I said, we're not dealing with a lot of sort of famous names, but perhaps he's one of the slightly better known ones in the New Zealand lineup. And he kind of came out fighting, hit a rapid 84, including 11 fours as well, you know, particularly again in the context of a time of slower scoring. Very aggressive way to go out and bat when your team are at 87 for 4. And New Zealand, they finished the opening day at 203 for 6. And this is when the weather sort of intervenes and makes things a little bit interesting. That evening, there was a tropical cyclone, which basically made batting interesting on the second day.
Did you get many of those at Lord's?
No, not nearly enough of them, in fact. And New Zealand soon all out for 255, but soon their bowlers were tearing through the West Indian lineup. Again, not particularly sort of famous names here. The star of the day was Tony McGibbon, who probably in the decisive spell of the match had both Sobers and Weekes caught behind in the space of just a few overs.
It's an amazingly sort of altogether, it's an amazingly gutsy performance by the New Zealanders when you think that they're already 3-0 down in the series.
And as you, I mean, as you made the point, you know, they've not just 3-0 down; they've been humiliated really throughout.
Yeah. And also, particularly with their batting, we talked about John Reid coming in and scoring that aggressive 84. But for a team that had just a year before scored 24 all out against England, actually to have the guts to go out and say, right, I'm actually going to attack as a batsman rather than just stonewalling and accumulating.
I mean, perhaps there was an extent of let's just go for it, we're in so much trouble. Yeah. So the West Indies in reply, in a lot of trouble. I mean, Sobers and Weekes, probably the key men gone. Only really their opener, the interestingly named Hammond Furlong, who was only to play 3 tests for the West Indies, and this was probably his, this was his highest score. He batted for 3.5 hours to make a painstaking 64, and this allowed the West Indies to at least scrape their way to 145. Time, though, was running out for New Zealand to force a result. The scoring rate had been very slow, some time had been lost to rain. If they were going to try and get their first test win, which obviously they were desperate to do so, you know, we're talking nearly 3 decades that they've been waiting. They had to go for it, and generally their batsmen struggled. Interestingly, Sammy Gillen, the wicketkeeper, was the key player. He made a very rapid fire 41, and this put New Zealand in a position where they could push for the win. It gave the West Indies a formidable 268 to chase in just 4 hours. The interesting thing about Sammy...
It's also a formidable task to take 10 wickets in 4 hours.
That's it's a very good point. I mean, the interesting thing about the wicketkeeper, Sammy Gwillan, who effectively set this opportunity up, is that he's actually one of a very rare breed of players to have played Test cricket for two countries. Oh, I mean, a Trinidadian who had actually played 5 Tests for the West Indies before moving to New Zealand. Mm. So interestingly, you know, he played the key role in this first victory. It's hard to tell, obviously, from the match reports we've got, how West Indies approached this. You get the feeling that, you know, they're 3-0 up, they've got players of the quality of Sobers and Weekes. You get the feeling that they probably went for
it. A little bit of arrogance, you know, if they can chase 268 in 4 hours, they have completely annihilated the West Indies.
And,
you know, it's really,
and what do they have to lose? Jugular. You know, they are 3-0 up. And certainly things go wrong for them pretty tragically. They find themselves at 22 for 6. Harry Cave taking 4 wickets for New Zealand. However, Everton Weekes is still there, and his form has been something quite extraordinary in this series. I mean, he's made a century in each of the 3 preceding tests. And New Zealand probably, you know, would still, with him there would have been a lot of concerns for them. The decisive moment came when he went for a big hit off the young leg spinner, the wonderfully named Alabaster, and was caught on the boundary. And the West Indies, in the end, dismissed for just 77, which was at the time, their lowest score in Test cricket. To a book review, and this week we're looking at Shane Warne's Century, My Top 100 Test Cricketers. Now, I think a lot of cricket fans love these discussions of which involve, you know, ranking players against each other, seeing who you would put, you know, in your top 11. And there's something very, very fun, I think, about a player of Shane Warne's ability and a player who does know an awful lot of the game, sort of testing himself in that way and trying to make these decisions. Is this top 100 format useful? Is it too artificial? I mean,
well, it's interesting how this fits in with some of the other top 100 books that have come out recently. John Woodcock, the ex Telegraph, is he Telegraph or Times?
Possibly
cricket correspondent. One or the other.
Who has
been around for a long, long time, did a top 100. Christopher Martin Jenkins has done a top 100 as well.
I think loads. It's a very popular.
It's a popular thing.
It's but a very what, popular what, stocking filler book, isn't it? From quite a lot of authors.
It is for reading on the loo. And what I think is so good about the Shane Warne one. Well, not as what's so good, but what is so different is that this is obviously so much more tongue-in-cheek, and it's so obviously partisan. Whereas when Christopher Martin Jenkins does it, he does it as a journalist who is quite a sort of highbrow journalist, and he's trying to be as objective as possible.
If you take the top 100 concept overly seriously, I think it becomes ridiculous. I think if you're honestly saying, I rank this person as better than this, whereas I think I agree with you that I think for Warne, he limits himself, interestingly, to players who he knows, players who he played with or against, and that adds a sort of honesty to it.
And what also is quite interesting is the way that he, so clearly, it's not just on ability per se, it's actually a lot of it is on whether he likes
the boys personally through
and all of those kind
we
of
might as well cut straight to the chase, which is, you know, do we agree with his picks? You know, what do we, I mean, the main objection I have, and I think we can all find a lot of examples to back this up, there is a very considerable Australian bias here. I mean, my personal gripe, well, I've got a few. I mean, Ian Healy in at number 10, David Boone in at number 21.
Jamie Siddons in at number 100.
Jamie Siddons in the list at all.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I suppose it was difficult, though, in that so many of those Australian cricketers he knew personally, and once he'd included a few, he kind of felt he had to include others.
And looking down the list of the 2005 side, absolutely every single one of the Australian players who played in 2005 Ashes is in there, apart from Michael Kasparich and Simon Cassidy. You kind of wonder what Ashley Giles did wrong as well, why he's not in
Giles there. Doesn't get an inclusion.
And then of the early 2000s Australia side as well, basically everyone is in there. And one of the things that does strike you is the way that he repeatedly refers to players as Bud and Buddy and, you know, good luck, mate, he says at the end of good luck, Bud, it says at the end of Ricky Ponting's one.
It's funny because there was a bit of a fuss when this book came out about the fact that a ghostwriter is at no point acknowledged or referenced, and yet we are led to believe that Richard Hobson of the Times did help him ghostwrite it. And it's odd because you kind of get that feeling at times that there is someone trying to be Shane Warne, and perhaps the you know, the repeated buds are part of that. I would agree though with some of his picks though. I thought he made a very bold call in putting Wasim Akram as high at number six, and I think he was right actually. You know, a player who deserves that sort of acknowledgement. Good decision as well, Andy Flower in the top 25. You know, very easy
to
forget.
Yes, very easily overlooked
someone like
because
that.
He was playing for such a interesting team. I don't know if we've mentioned it. This was published in 2008, and Monty Panesar is higher than Rahul Dravid.
Are you sure that's right?
Which is an interesting. I'm pretty sure it's right. I'm just quickly skipping through. Certainly Monty Panesar is.
He's certainly far too high.
Is higher than. He's higher than Ganguly. Monty Panesar gets in there at 92, above Devon Malcolm, Ganguly, Afridi, Graham Thorpe, and James.
I think
Siddons.
Monty Panesar above Shahid Afridi is probably
an interesting one.
But
what comes through in his profile of Monty Panesar, which I quite like, because he just says he's quite a fun. As I say, this was written in 2008. He's quite a fun cricketer. He's got bags of potential. Why not let's stick him in? And it's almost as if he's trying to provoke debate. And I think that's exactly what this kind of
and this
book
top 100 format is built for the pub debate, isn't it? It's built to provoke discussion, and the book certainly succeeds in doing that. As for the profiles themselves, I think these are varied, frankly, in quality. I mean, I think where they fail is when they basically just state the obvious. I mean, there's so much about famous players that we just know. I mean, there was one piece that caught my attention where he talks about how impossible it is to get Chanderpaul out. And I was thinking, well, frankly, that
tell
is the Chanderpaul
new.
Cliche.
Tell us,
it's interesting when he gives you those sort of insights that you could only get as a player. I mean, a fascinating piece on Anil Kumble, where he talks about how him and Kumble shared the different grips, shared their different bowling techniques, and would discuss them. And you thought, it's kind of fascinating that two leading spinners, you know, very serious rivals, would be so open and so honest with each other.
And these little kind of snapshots are absolutely fascinating. And there's some stuff about Tendulkar in a game when Tendulkar's cover drive was sort of playing up a bit, and Tendulkar scored 160 without playing the cover drive once, which is just a kind of phenomenal. And then there's there are some great anecdotes about Mark Waugh batting against India and the way that he went about that. And partly the problem is, though, that you get these kind of two-liners, and then because the format is such that he only has 500 words to talk about each player, that it never kind of develops into a fully-fledged account. And one of the quite attractive things about this book is that it gives, a very biased and one-sided, but a view of a particular time of the game and of the game that Shane Warne knew throughout his career from the early 90s through to the late 2000s.
Yeah.
And the problem is, though, as I say, that they are very limited sort of snapshots.
Yeah, I mean, I think his honesty is run throughout the book. And I mean, you know, there's for all the mistakes in judgment that kind of characterise his career, I think people who've seen Shane Warne play know he's a thinking cricketer, and it has come across. I was fascinated actually by two of the profiles where I felt he was very covertly having a bit of a go at certain players. His profile on Muralitharan, who he ranks very well. I think he puts Murali as high as 7. But he says this rather interesting thing. He says, it doesn't matter whether or not the ICC changed the law to accommodate him. Yeah. And you kind of feel like you've mentioned it right at the start of the profile. He also then talks about how Murali wastes his ability in the IPL. He talks about how he struggled so much in Australia. And you kind of feel, well, surely this is supposed to be praising him, but it's such a critical profile.
And on the flip side of that, on the flip side of doing some players down, he's also very keen to sort of patch up relations with some players. So Graham Smith, and I mean, they must be absolutely chalk and cheese as people, Graham Smith and Shane Warne. And basically the entirety of the account of Graham Smith simply revolves around the fact that when Shane Warne and Graham Smith got together in the IPL dressing room, they didn't have a huge argument. I mean, that's what it's all about. We found out we had a good laugh about the past, that kind of thing.
I suppose the difficulty is, in writing this book, just as his career was ending, really, just as his test career had ended, pretty much, is that you don't really have any distance from the game. These are players who you'll be meeting regularly. I mean, Warne was still an active IPL player when this book came out. And so it's hard for you to say certain things and be entirely honest. I mean, also, Steve Waugh's another person he has a bit of a go at, without openly, he seems to question maybe how much of that Australian team's success was Waugh's and how much of it was really established by Mark Taylor beforehand. But I mean, would you say, I mean, as a book, is this the kind of book you sit down and read back to back? Or would you say, you know, you used that rather derogatory term earlier of a toilet read? I mean, is this a toilet read?
Well, I did try to sit down and read it
from the toilet
to cover. From cover to cover. I'm rarely on the toilet long enough to read a 400-page book from cover to cover. But it's a great dipping book. But I mean, the unfortunate thing is that there is quite a lot of dross in it, and there are some profiles you read, and you do, as you pointed out earlier with Chanderpaul, you do think, well, come on, tell me something new.
Yeah.
There are also some amusing anecdotes, and actually so there's two things. It's a good sort of look into the game in which Warne operated, but it's also quite interesting. I think it reflects on Shane Warne quite heavily, the things that he's saying, and also the way that he kind of uses this book to sort of try and
Does it reflect positively on him? Or it's hard, isn't it? There are parts where he comes across as I mean, I think generally he comes across as very honest and a man who loved the game and had respect, actually. Had a huge amount of respect for his... But, I mean, would you say generally he personally comes out well from the book?
Or? I don't know if he comes out well. I think it tells us a lot about him, particularly in those moments when he's talking less positively about certain players. But I think it's... No, I think it's a... We were talking about whether it's ghostwritten and the extent to which it's ghostwritten. But one of its qualities is it does have, most of the time, quite a lot of character.
Mm.
Just as Warne had quite a lot of character. Still does, probably. That's why we're talking about him in the past.
Definitely not
his
dead.
Life isn't over now his test career is. But, no, but I mean, what do you take away from the book as a
whole? Well, I think it's certainly a lively read. But I think you're right in that it certainly suits dipping. And I think I found myself instinctively flicking to, ooh, I wonder what Warne thinks about this player.
Yep.
That, and there were certain profiles. I have to say, I got to a stage where I couldn't handle reading any of his Australian profiles because I knew it was going to be too...
So Macy.
Yeah.
The blogs, and this episode we are going to the Board Cricket Crazy Indians, which is boardcricketcrazyindians.com, cryptically. Coincidentally, BCCI is their acronym. This is a fascinating blog, which I think Andy, you've known about for a while, but you pointed it out to me, and I've just been flicking through over the last couple of days, and it's got a great combination of cartoons, debates, whose name I don't think we're allowed to mention in it.
Master Debates.
It's also, there are a lot of guest posts as well, which there's a good variety of all kinds of different.
I mean, we try and look for blogs that are doing stuff well and also doing stuff in an interesting way. And I think, you know, particularly use of different formats. I don't think I know another blog that is as inventive as this. I mean, we've got at the top today, we've got a cartoon of Sachin Tendulkar and Harry Potter discussing Quidditch. You know, very
original. With
Roger
Federer looking on.
With Roger Federer looking on. So good use of comics. And, you know, a really good use of audio as well. I mean, these very formally structured debates with their sort of speeches on major issues and stuff. I think just quite interestingly structured and doing them formally, giving someone a set period of time to speak and stuff, does add something quite interesting to it.
And there's another good thing, which is that because it doesn't seem as a blog to have a particular sort of a remit, it doesn't seem to narrow itself down to anything particularly. So there's this great picture on the front page of cricket in Shillong after the 1897 earthquake, and it's just little things like that which people have come in, and as I say, there are a lot of guests, people come in and stick on there, which means it's completely eclectic and you don't know what you're going to find, but there's a lot of
interest. The real strength of a group blog and a group blog like this that clearly encourages collaboration, and we obviously have to say we've benefited from some of that collaboration
today.
Wonderful 2-minute preview earlier, is that it does add variety. And obviously I think it can be very, very difficult for an individual blogger to maintain constantly interesting stuff. You've obviously got a group of people doing that, each with their sort of own opinions, their own views. I mean, one post I think we both liked is this piece on why India shouldn't become a dominant force in Test cricket, why that would be a bad thing.
Why it should become a dynasty rather than a dominant force. It's something that we've talked about in relation to Australia, actually, when we were talking about Ricky Ponting earlier in the year, and the way that one of my big sort of bugbears is the way in which when Australia built up their great side, they didn't, it was so strong that effectively the next generation was lost. Hussey was an exception, but you had people making their Test debuts and, you know, coming in. I mean, Stuart McGill is the perfect example, who only actually ended up making playing a few tests and doing it very successfully. But this blog makes the point that the same thing shouldn't be happening to India, and to have a completely dominant side, to have 11 amazing players, can actually be a very destructive thing for a cricketing nation, simply because it doesn't allow new talent to be brought through and it leaves a void behind it.
And I think that distinction between sort of dynasty and dominance is interesting, you know, that idea of looking forward into the long term. I mean, I think the other thing is, it's become a sort of cliche how the game is now sort of Indian dominated, how all the power flows from India. But I think it's very, very healthy in terms of the cricket blogosphere that we have a strong Indian voice, you know, that we have a sort of kind of a voice articulating kind of an Indian perspective on issues. So I think that certainly makes it interesting. Good to see as well, we noted a post at the moment from the Old Batsman blog, a blog that we've actually profiled here before.
Fantastic
and that
stuff.
Kind of sort of collaboration between Indian blogosphere, English blogosphere is really interesting to see. So yeah, Board Cricket Crazy Indians, as Toby said, at www.boardcricketcrazyindians.com. Go there now. And finally, to the debate. Should we be worried about the rise of dissent in county cricket? And this is in the wake of quite a few separate incidents, isn't it? James Foster's been in trouble.
Murray Goodwin
and Marcus Trezeguet have all got themselves into trouble for their sort of conduct towards umpires. And obviously, away from the county game, Stuart Broad as well has been in trouble.
As he always is.
As he does seem to be rather too much.
That fine example of an England captain. I mean, it's interesting how England seem to have said, give the bad boy the responsibility and see if it clears him up.
Anyway, dragging us back
anyway,
to the debate.
Yes.
I mean, firstly, I'm sort of curious about the issue of to what extent these incidents represent a real shift in the climate. I mean, do you think there has been a real change, or has it maybe just been coincidental? We've had a string of incidents.
I thought maybe it was until I thought about what the cause of this might be. And I think one of the major causes of it is actually the DRS.
I'm not a big fan of the DRS in
general, but I hope I'm not just jumping on my usual bandwagon here. I'm not going to start complaining about 2020 cricket as well. I'm just focused on the DRS.
What you're effectively going to do is twist this debate so that you can rant about 2020
and the
DRS.
No, I'm not. But what I am going to say is that the problem with DRS is that it is, in a sense, a method of ritual humiliation for umpires, because they stand there and they see their decisions quibbled with and then overhauled. And I just worry about whether it kind of breaks down their authority to a large extent, because in the past, when DRS didn't exist at all, you'd appeal for something for an LB, it would be given not out, and you knew there was nothing you could do about it, you know, and that's why it was there wasn't too much dissent, there wasn't anything like that, which was...
And the umpire, ultimately, in those circumstances, was entirely in charge, and there was no...
Exactly.
I mean, because, you know, we aren't going to have an argument about the DRS, but I, while supporting the system, I do appreciate that it clearly has changed the perspective on the umpires. I mean, I'm curious as to whether cricket has to be very careful about this, because... I'm a follower of football as well, and within football, dissent has got to such a sort of horrendous level, really. Yeah. It's one of the real blights of football, I think, as a sport.
And there seems to be no going back, really.
There doesn't appear to be a coherent way of going back. So I think cricket has long been very much celebrated for the way the players behave. So it is something that we've got to be very strong in our response to.
I wonder whether there's another aspect which is, at the moment, bringing cricket further towards football than it has in the past, which is with the rise of big money tournaments and big celebrity like the IPL. I mean, one of the problems with, as I see it, one of the problems kind of inherent within football which brings about dissent is that a lot of players think that they are God's gift to the world, and if they're told they've done something wrong, then it couldn't possibly be true.
So it's an arrogance thing.
They're the greatest thing on earth. And I wonder whether that is related to a culture of celebrity.
Well, it's interesting how several of these incidents in cricket have come within the 2020 format, where for the counties and for the players involved, you know, if they impress, they get an IPL contract. There's a lot on the line. I mean, for the counties, there's the Champions League and the money that will bring. So perhaps you're right. I mean, raising the stakes has certainly done an issue. I mean, in terms of the response, the county game have looked to sort of issue bans. I mean, I've been curious as to, how extreme that it needs to be. I think I'm on the side at this stage that let's be very extreme, let's be quite severe in our punishments, just because, in a sense, maybe give those first sort of group of players who are getting into trouble a very difficult time to just try to put off future offenders.
I mean, I, as we've said, that as I've said, I think the DRS is quite heavily connected with this. And I actually wonder whether, if you want to root out dissent entirely, what you have to do is you have to have, at the centre of the game, a pillar of authority that can't be questioned. In the past, that was the umpire, and the umpire's decision was final. Now it's DRS. And actually, I think realistically, you can't have the type of DRS we've got at the moment and umpires and maintain the umpire's authority. I mean, actually, if you want to root out dissent entirely, I think you should just get rid of the umpires and put, you know, put a computer out there, because then there's no way anyone can complain.
Right, so you've
about
gone,
what's going
so
on.
A couple of minutes ago we were anti-DRS, now umpires being...
No, but I'm saying you can't have both. You can't complain about standards of behaviour in the game and dissent against an umpire whose authority is being completely undermined by structures that are brought
position, because of the fact that DRS is there in some parts of the game and isn't in others, and as a result, players' attitudes are maybe slightly confused by that.
I mean, why you can't have DRS, which is we're moving slightly to the side here, but I think it is connected. But why you can't have DRS, which is decided by the umpire when the umpire wants to use it? Because at the moment it's tactical and it's not explicitly about the decision per se, because otherwise you just review every single decision.
Yeah.
And it would invest more authority in the umpire if the umpire could decide when to use DRS. And so if something was completely clear-cut, then they wouldn't need to review it. But if there was a doubt, they could review it, and they would keep their authority.
Let's just abandon any pretense that we're not discussing the DRS. Yep. We're definitely discussing DRS now.
Everyone's got an extra half an hour.
I think we'll just keep going straight into the next episode. I think the issue with giving it to the umpire is just that suddenly the umpire finds himself in a position where actually, if they don't refer a decision, you know, and if it's their responsibility to do it, if they don't refer it upstairs and it turns out to have been out, then, you know, it makes them look even more ridiculous. Like, if, for example, you give an LBW not out and you refuse it, and we're giving that responsibility to the umpires to send it upstairs, then people are going to be more... I mean, at least the present system, it's the players' fault. If they don't refer it, that's their decision. So I think nobody quite understood fully what it's done to the umpires. I mean, dragging it back to the debate for a moment, I'm just not sure... I'm positive, I'm optimistic that this isn't a sea change in the game, actually, in terms of behaviour. For all the cricket I watch, I still think overwhelmingly the behaviour is good. And as I said, if you contrast it with the vast majority of other sports, I mean, particularly football, I think it's still very good. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said at the beginning, I don't think this is kind of an epidemic yet. But I think it's certainly an issue that those in authority would be wise to keep an eye on.
Well, thank you for listening to all of that, including that sort of... Slightly extended session, and including that impromptu DRS argument. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, at which time the series of the summer will be well underway.
If it hasn't been rained off, which apparently is a
lot. Well, and if it's sort of as it is at the moment, then yeah, maybe we'll just be back to report on an exciting week's rain at Lord's.